up next. On this last day in office for President Barack Obama, we present a special encore, Power of Words. WAMC's Alan Schar talk in conversation with Jonathan Alter about President Obama's inaugural address. Words are powerful. They cause fear, confusion, and anger. Or they can create shared understanding. But when words are delivered by a powerful political leader, their impact can inspire us to great action. And it is to those words that we turn now. In the Power of Words.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Welcome to The Power of Words, a year-long series of programs that follows American history through some of the most memorable and inspiring political speeches of our time. Our series continues today with one of the most anticipated presidential speeches of all time, Barack Obama's inaugural address delivered on January 20th, 2009. Joining us today to help us analyze the speech is award-winning columnist, television analyst, and author Jonathan Alter. Jonathan Alter is a senior editor at Newsweek, where, since 1991, he has written an acclaimed column on politics, history, media, and society at large. He's also an analyst and contributing correspondent for NBC News. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, a national bestseller published by Simon & Schuster in 2006. His 2010 book is The Promise, President Obama Year One, published by Simon & Schuster, a behind-the-scenes look at Obama's eventful debut. Alter is a Chicago, Illinois native and resides in Montclair, New Jersey, with his wife and three children. Welcome, Jonathan Alter.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so help us set the scene here, Jonathan Alter. It's January 20th, 2009. Over 1 million people have gathered in the mall in Washington to hear what was arguably one of the most anticipated inaugural speeches by any president, let alone the first African-American president. At the time of the speech, the country faced the most difficult set of challenges since the Great Depression. So while Barack Obama campaigned successfully on the banner of hope and change, his inaugural had to deal with the coming storm. So Jonathan Alter, how did he do?
Well, I think he did well, but he did not deliver the soaring rhetoric that a lot of people waiting on the mall and watching around the world, and there were tens, if not hundreds of millions of people who were watching the speech, he didn't deliver the kind of inspirational address that they expected. And that was done intentionally. I have a lot in The Promise about the preparation of this speech, and his basic feeling was that, you know, having used his lyricism to get elected, he essentially chose to set that instrument aside in favor of, you know, a more practical tool to present a more sober reality, a more sober picture of the challenges facing the country and the world, and to lower Americans' expectations, which were so high that they were in danger of crippling his presidency before it even got off the ground.
So I have a follow-up question. Do you think he made the right choice in tempering it down?
I do. The line that people remember comes from Scripture. It's time to set aside childish things. He was trying to offer a sober address and, you know, introduce his larger theme, which was a new era of responsibility for the country. The problem is that that childish things soundbite that I just mentioned was the only soundbite in the whole speech, the only thing that anybody could remember, and it came from Scripture. So, you know, Obama and his speechwriters decided not just to set aside childish things, but to set aside any line that was simple and catchy enough for people to actually commit to memory and to, you know, emblazon on the Obama paraphernalia the way the only thing we have to fear is fear itself was, or ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. There was none of that. And I think that continues to be a problem that Obama has, which is he gives a very impressive speech. It has a powerful effect on the audience at the time, but it wears off much too fast because of his allergy to sound bites. And that really began in the inaugural address.
Do you have any sense of the psychology of the man that obviously he fears the soaring Rooseveltian rhetoric? He wants to keep it simple, but what motivates that?
Well, he doesn't fear it. He used it a lot during the campaign. Mm-hmm. I think he subscribes to Mario Cuomo's famous dictum, which is that you campaign in poetry and govern in prose. And he's just taken that idea too much to heart. So as we get back into a campaign mode in 2010 and then again in 2012, you will see him use more of the soaring inspirational rhetoric that helped get him elected. But when it comes to talking about policy, he wants to make Americans more serious and sober and not transport them in a way that will essentially distract them from the seriousness of the current and long-term problems. So I think that the tone of the speech was right for the occasion. If he had delivered this tremendously inspirational speech just before he went into all of these intense, grubby legislative struggles, the contrast would have been too great. So I think he was right to try to take the temperature down and have a thoughtful rather than a soaring inaugural. But he took it too far by not having enough memorable lines. And also, there's one particular section of the speech that I think reflects what became, despite a lot of successes in his first year and a half, became his biggest failure. You know, he said, "We gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord." Well, we didn't really choose that. We chose to elect Barack Obama president, but we did not choose hope over fear and unity over conflict. And he went on to say, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recriminations and worn-out dogmas that for too long have strangled our politics. That shows that he was overreading the message of his election, that he thought that he could essentially lead the country to a new place. And in that sense, he was setting up expectations that he couldn't possibly meet and didn't meet. Not only did we not have an end to petty grievances, we had an acceleration of those recriminations. So he accomplished a lot in his first year and a half or so. Many of the themes that he struck in the inaugural about re-engaging with the world, he made good on. He was the first president ever to reach out to the Muslim world in an inaugural address, which is an extraordinarily important thing to do at this moment, and he's made good on that. But in terms of moving into a post-partisan era, which is part of what he outlined in this address, he didn't succeed.
What is it that scares Republicans the way they are obviously scared about Barack Obama?
Well, change is always threatening. And, you know, the prospect of moving back into an era where government might at least offer some solutions is very threatening to what they see as their ideology. You know, importantly, in this speech, Reagan had said in his inaugural, government is the problem, quote unquote. And Clinton later said in one of his State of the Union addresses, the era of big government is over. Obama said in his inaugural, and I think this is a real key to his whole approach to governing, the line was, the question we ask today is not whether government is too big or too small, but whether it works. That, you know, is a pragmatic, post-ideological way of approaching government that reflects his efforts from the time he first came into national prominence to move beyond the red state, blue state divides. But it was easily caricatured by the Republicans amid a crisis where both Bush and Obama had to spend a lot of money to prevent a depression. So they were able to turn him into a big spending traditional liberal that they consider to be very threatening. There are obviously some opponents for whom there's a racial dimension. I think that the class and status dimension is a more important one. After all, you know, he got 54% of the vote, the most since any Democrat since Lyndon Johnson in 1964. So America voted for him. But you have about one-fifth of the public that has always been reactionary. And this goes back 100 years. Mm. In that sense, the whole Tea Party thing is just a new name for an old force in American politics, a reactionary force that is very resistant to change, very hardline right. And every prior Democratic president has had to put up with the same 20%. The challenge for Obama is not the severe critics on the far right who make a lot of noise. The challenge for him is that he's having trouble with independents. And that's where his speeches and his approach to office, his approach to the role of government, that's where it has the most consequences for him politically, is with those essentially moderates who sometimes vote Democratic, sometimes vote Republican. And he carried them in 2008, but has struggled with independents in the months since.
The book that Jonathan Alter wrote about this is The Promise, President Obama, Year One, published by Simon & Schuster. So, Jonathan, first of all, I just want you to know, as a guy who interviewed Mario Cuomo and had a show with him every week for over a decade, I can tell you he may have said that, you know, in prose and poetry, but he tried the poetry throughout his administration, too.
And I think Obama is wrong to make such a rigid distinction. And he does try poetry from time to time. He had three very successful speeches in front of a joint session of Congress, and he used some poetry in all three. So it's not as if he has completely rejected the lyrical notes in his speaking. And my book ends with a speech he gave at the Vermont Baptist Church in Washington right after the Democrats lost the race to succeed Ted Kennedy in Massachusetts. And that was a very emotional, lyrical speech. But I think he's having trouble finding the right key in his public presentation. And he said not too long ago that this is not theater. And I think in that the president was quite wrong, that the presidency has always been at least partly about theater. And he understands that in his prepared speeches, but I think his overall approach to the office could use a little more theater. His concern, of course, is that if he's too theatrical, then he loses his authenticity, which has always been his calling card, that he's not just another phony politician. But I got very interested in reporting for The Promise in the way he writes speeches and the way he prepares them. And there's quite a lot in the book for people who are interested in speech writing and speech delivery. And I spoke to Jon Favreau, his chief speechwriter, and his other speechwriters. And one of the things that struck me was how, from the very beginning, from when he announced for president in Springfield, Illinois in 2007, he has always worked up right to the last minute revising speeches. And that comes out of Obama's habit of thinking that he can hit the 3-point shot at the buzzer. And so he always thinks and usually succeeds in kind of pulling it out at the last minute. But even Michael Jordan, one of his heroes, you know, missed at the buzzer sometimes. And I think we saw in his speech on the BP oil spill from the Oval Office that not every one of his speeches is seen as a successful one.
John Alter, we definitely had the impression during the Bush administration, the Bush years, that he was not in charge. There were those around him who were, maybe Cheney, maybe others, but he wasn't. Is Barack Obama in charge?
He's very much in charge. And this is why, for all the, you know, the fun stories I have about Rambo, as Rahm Emanuel is called, and his other aides, my book is very much about him. He has what in the military they call the habit of command. All of the many critics who thought he was wrecking the country, not a single one of them has suggested that the job is too big for him or that he's not in charge. And his way of making a decision behind closed doors fascinated me. So I tried to take the reader inside the Oval Office, the cabinet room, the Situation Room, where national security decisions are made, to explain in some detail the way he makes a decision and runs a meeting and conveys his command of the situation. His problem is that having stripped emotion out of the equation in private, which is one of the things that helps him with his crisp decision making and gives him not a guarantee that he's going to make the right decision, but better odds because the process is disciplined and effective, in part because there's no emotion in it. He's unsentimental when he's making these decisions. But then he neglects sometimes to reinsert the emotion in his public presentation. And I think we saw that with the inaugural. He intended it to be sober and restrained and not be a barn-burning speech. And one thing I learned that I found interesting about the preparation of the inaugural was that his speechwriters were telling him that because it was cold and the audience would be mostly wearing gloves, he wouldn't hear the clapping. And Obama said, I think his line was, "That's good. I'd rather not hear any applause and just speak to people." He was not trying for applause lines in that speech. He was trying to have a conversation with the country and the world upon taking office. So I think the inaugural has to be analyzed in the context of his intentions.
Have you ever worried about, as I did, as my wife did, as everybody did, you know, about his physical safety and wondering about this ramping down of the tone in terms of understanding that, you know, if they couldn't get it their way with him one way, they might try it in another, which certainly is not anathematic to the American experience.
Well, I can tell you there's no connection between the tone that he strikes and his concern about physical safety. There was a very dramatic terrorist threat that I write about in The Promise on the day of the inauguration, which they confronted in secret, and he actually canceled one of his speech rehearsals in order to deal with this threat. And Hillary Clinton said that in the meetings with the outgoing and incoming National Security Council that the inaugural would proceed even if a bomb did explode on the Mall, because we wouldn't have terrorists disrupting our inauguration. But in a larger sense, he's not in any danger. The Secret Service does a good job, and I don't think he worries about it. In fact, interestingly, he jokes about the threats sometimes to his safety. He had an African-American friend over who was a slender guy like him, and the friend wanted to go out on the Truman balcony, and he said, "Yeah, go ahead, go out there. You might get shot." And so he laughs at the dangers and doesn't really let them affect what he wants to do. Now, he's much more concerned about a series of long-term threats to the country and being the adult. And part of being the adult is trying to talk to people in ways that sober them up and get them to face some of these long-term challenges. So if he's erred in not being inspirational enough, it's because he's too much of what I call the professor-in-chief, trying to instruct rather than inspire, and he does so very intentionally.
Now, Lincoln came out of Illinois, so does he. He announced in Springfield, obviously. Nobody missed that. We will never hear Lincoln. But we read Lincoln. Did he aspire to Lincoln-esque presentation?
He does. Lincoln is Barack Obama's favorite president. And when he turns the other cheek, when he's criticized and doesn't satisfy his supporters by, whacking somebody, throwing a punch, a lot of times he's thinking of Lincoln with malice toward none, with charity for all. And Lincoln was often accused of being too passive, and he didn't fire back at critics. He even imitates Lincoln's habit of going into his staff secretary's office and sitting in a chair opposite the desk and putting his feet up on their desk, which is exactly what Barack Obama does. Unlike any president in the 150 years since, he can routinely be found and doing that. And he wanders around the West Wing. I was sitting in David Axelrod's office one day when he just wandered in. And when I interviewed him, he didn't have his feet up on the desk in the Oval Office, but he might just as well have. Now that, you might say, well, that's a pretty small thing to imitate Lincoln on. And he might have done it anyway, even if Lincoln didn't. But the comparisons to Lincoln, which he's afraid to make publicly because he was ridiculed for them early in the campaign, are an important part of the way he sees himself. And I think his firing of General McChrystal also came with some reflection on
McClellan.
Lincoln had to fire McClellan and some other generals. And he sees Lincoln's equanimity, his calm amid crisis, as instructive for him.
You're listening to The Power of Words, a co-production of WAMC and the New York State Archives Partnership Trust. I'm Alan Shartok, and we're here with Jonathan Alter, senior editor at Newsweek, columnist, TV commentator, and acclaimed author. His latest book is The Promise, President Obama, Year One, published by Simon & Schuster, a behind-the-scenes look at Obama's eventful debut. Okay, now that we've set the scene for Barack Obama's inaugural speech, it's time to listen.
Thank you. Thank you. My fellow citizens,
I stand here today humbled by the task before us, grateful for the trust you've bestowed, mindful of the sacrifices borne by our ancestors. I thank President Bush for his service to our nation. As well as the generosity and cooperation he has shown throughout this transition. 44 Americans have now taken the presidential oath. The words have been spoken during rising tides of prosperity and the still waters of peace. Yet, every so often, the oath is taken amidst gathering clouds and raging storms. At these moments, America has carried on not simply because of the skill or vision of those in high office, but because we, the people, have remained faithful to the ideals of our forebears and true to our founding documents. So it has been, so it must be with this generation of Americans. That we are in the midst of crisis is now well understood. Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age. Homes have been lost, jobs shed, businesses shutter. Our health care is too costly, our schools fail too many. And each day brings further evidence that the ways we use energy strengthen our adversaries and threaten our planet. These are the indicators of crisis, subject to data and statistics. Less measurable, but no less profound, is a sapping of confidence across our land. A nagging fear that America's decline is inevitable, that the next generation must lower its sights. Today, I say to you that the challenges we face are real. They are serious and they are many. They will not be met easily or in a short span of time. But know this, America, they will be met. On this day, we gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord. On this day, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recriminations and worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics. We remain a young nation, but in the words of Scripture, the time has come to set aside childish things. The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness. In reaffirming the greatness of our nation, we understand that greatness is never a given. It must be earned. Our journey has never been one of shortcuts or settling for less. It has not been the path for the faint-hearted, for those who prefer leisure over work or seek only the pleasures of riches and fame. Rather, it has been the risk-takers, the doers, the makers of things, some celebrated, but more often men and women obscure in their labor, who have carried us up the long, rugged path towards prosperity and freedom. For us, they packed up their few worldly possessions and traveled across oceans in search of a new life. For us, they toiled in sweatshops and settled the West, endured the lash of the whip, and plowed the hard earth. For us, they fought and died in places like Concord and Gettysburg, Normandy and Quezon. Time and again, these men and women struggled and sacrificed and worked till their hands were raw so that we might live a better life. They saw America as bigger than the sum of our individual ambitions, greater than all the differences of birth or wealth or faction. This is the journey we continue today. We remain the most prosperous, powerful nation on earth. Our workers are no less productive than when this crisis began. Our minds are no less inventive, our goods and services no less needed than they were last week or last month or last year. Our capacity remains undiminished, but our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed. Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. For everywhere we look, there is work to be done. The state of our economy calls for action, bold and swift, and we will act, not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth. We will build the roads and bridges, the electric grids and digital lines that feed our commerce and bind us together. We will restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its cost. We will harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories, and we will transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet the demands of a new age. All this we can do. All this we will do. Now, there are some who question the scale of our ambitions, who suggest that our system cannot tolerate too many big plans. Their memories are short, for they have forgotten what this country has already done, what free men and women can achieve when imagination is joined to common purpose and necessity to courage. What the cynics fail to understand is that the ground has shifted beneath them, that the stale political arguments that have consumed us for so long no longer apply. The question we ask today is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works, whether it helps families find jobs at a decent wage, care they can afford, a retirement that is dignified. Where the answer is yes, we intend to move forward. Where the answer is no, programs will end. And those of us who manage the public's dollars will be held to account to spend wisely, reform bad habits, and do our business in the light of day, because only then can we restore the vital trust between a people and their government. Nor is the question before us whether the market is a force for good or ill. Its power to generate wealth and expand freedom is unmatched. But this crisis has reminded us that without a watchful eye, the market can spin out of control. The nation cannot prosper long when it favors only the prosperous. The success of our economy has always depended not just on the size of our gross domestic product, but on the reach of our prosperity, on the ability to extend opportunity to every willing heart, not out of charity, but because it is the surest route to our common good. As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man, a charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake. And so, to all the other peoples and governments who are watching today, from the grandest capitals to the small village where my father was born, know that America is a friend of each nation and every man, woman, and child who seeks a future of peace and dignity, and we are ready to lead once more. Recall that earlier generations faced down fascism and communism not just with missiles and tanks, but with the sturdy alliances and enduring convictions. They understood that our power alone cannot protect us, nor does it entitle us to do as we please. Instead, they knew that our power grows through its prudent use. Our security emanates from the justness of our cause, the force of our example, the tempering qualities of humility and restraint. We are the keepers of this legacy. Guided by these principles once more, we can meet those new threats that demand even greater effort, even greater cooperation and understanding between nations. We will begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. With old friends and former foes, we will work tirelessly to lessen the nuclear threat and roll back the specter of a warming planet. We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. And for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you. For we know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers. We are shaped by every language and culture, drawn from every end of this earth. And because we have tasted the bitter swill of civil war and segregation and emerged from that dark chapter stronger and more united, we cannot help but believe that the old hatreds shall someday pass, that the lines of tribes shall soon dissolve, that as the world grows smaller, our common humanity shall reveal itself, and that America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace. To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect. To those leaders around the globe who seek to sow conflict or blame their society's ills on the West, know that your people will judge you on what you can build, not what you destroy. To those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent, know that you are on the wrong side of history, but that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist. To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow, to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds. And to those nations like ours that enjoy relative plenty, we say we can no longer afford indifference to the suffering outside our borders, nor can we consume the world's resources without regard to effect. For the world has changed, and we must change with it. As we consider the road that unfolds before us, we remember with humble gratitude those brave Americans who, at this very hour, patrol far-off deserts and distant mountains. They have something to tell us, just as the fallen heroes who lie in Arlington whisper through the ages. We honor them not only because they are the guardians of our liberty, but because they embody the spirit of service, a willingness to find meaning in something greater than themselves. And yet, at this moment, a moment that will define a generation, it is precisely this spirit that must inhabit us all. For as much as government can do and must do, it is ultimately the faith and determination of the American people upon which this nation relies. It is the kindness to take in a stranger when the levees break, the selflessness of workers who would rather cut their hours than see a friend lose their job, which sees us through our darkest hours. It is the firefighter's courage to storm a stairway filled with smoke, but also a parent's willingness to nurture a child that finally decides our fate. Our challenges may be new, The instruments with which we meet them may be new. But those values upon which our success depends, honesty and hard work, courage and fair play, tolerance and curiosity, loyalty and patriotism, these things are old. These things are true. They have been the quiet force of progress throughout our history. What is demanded then is a return to these truths. What is required of us now is a new era of responsibility, a recognition on the part of every American that we have duties to ourselves, our nation, and the world, duties that we do not grudgingly accept, but rather seize gladly, firm in the knowledge that there is nothing so satisfying to the spirit, so defining of our character, than giving our all to a difficult task. This is the price and the promise of citizenship. This is the source of our confidence, the knowledge that God calls on us to shape an uncertain destiny. This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath. So let us mark this day with remembrance of who we are and how far we have traveled. In the year of America's birth, in the coldest of months, a small band of patriots huddled by dying campfires on the shores of an icy river. The Capitol was abandoned. The enemy was advancing. The snow was stained with blood. At a moment when the outcome of our revolution was most in doubt, the father of our nation ordered these words be read to the people. Let it be told to the future world that in the depth of winter, when nothing but hope and virtue could survive, that the city and the country, alarmed at one common danger, came forth to meet it. America, in the face of our common dangers, in this winter of our hardship, let us remember these timeless words. With hope and virtue, let us brave once more the icy currents and endure what storms may come. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back, nor did we falter. And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
That was President Barack Obama's inaugural speech delivered January 20th, 2009. I'm Alan Chartok, and you're listening to The Power of Words, a year-long series of programs that follows American history through some of the most memorable and inspiring political speeches of our time. Joining us on the program today is Jonathan Alter, senior editor at Newsweek, columnist, TV commentator, and acclaimed author. Jonathan Alter, when we left, you were talking a little bit about the comparison between Lincoln and Obama. And I think it's pretty well known that Lincoln had bouts of melancholia. In other words, he was somewhat depressed. I don't think that seems to be true on the surface with Barack Obama, is it?
No, I don't think it is. I think he is perhaps not more psychologically healthy than the average person, but he is more psychologically healthy than the average politician. He's a remarkably sort of well-balanced person, in part because he worked through a lot of his issues when he was a younger man. He's not trying to figure out who he is. He doesn't have any history of depression, as Lincoln did. And he's not working out his ego issues and his relationships with other people, which saves him a lot of time. The problem for Obama is that being a person who's not needy himself, the neediness of other people or even the neediness of the American people is an abstraction for him. So it is not as natural as it might be for other politicians to, you know, reach out and stroke people and make them feel better and, you know, feel their pain, as Bill Clinton said. But I think in terms of his language that he uses, you know, I don't know where this allergy to sound bites comes from. He should know that a house divided against itself cannot stand, Lincoln, or the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, Roosevelt. These were sound bites. There's nothing wrong with a good sound bite, and yet he considers it to be somehow lowering himself or talking down to the American people or making too many concessions to the stupidity of the American media for him to talk in these catchphrases that people can get their hands around and minds around and that leave some imprint. We govern in this country often with metaphors, not cheesy one-liners, but lines that encapsulate belief. So when Ronald Reagan said, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, or George W. Bush said, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists, even if you didn't necessarily approve of the sentiment, and Obama definitely disapproves of the latter one, these help give tone and meaning to Reagan and Bush's presidencies. And what Obama is missing so far from his are these ideas that are encapsulated in language and words that people really remember. And now, he has to address this or he's not going to succeed long term.
Now, Jonathan Alter, when you were interviewing him and had this unprecedented access and all that you had, did you ever say that to him?
You know, I didn't. We were talking about Afghanistan and healthcare and the issues, but I did get the sense that it comes out of his impatience and disdain for the conventions of my business, the media. Mm. And so he would say to liberals during the healthcare debate who were complaining that there wasn't a public option when there weren't the votes, he said, look, we have to deal with the world as it is, not as, you know, you and I might like it to be. Let's deal with reality in a pragmatic way. He's a highly pragmatic president. But he doesn't take his own advice when it comes to the media. And he should deal with the media more as it is than as he wants it to be.
I love that.
So I guess in this interview that I did with him when we were talking about foreign policy, some of this surfaced. He had just been in Asia, and he said that the president of South Korea had a huge domestic problem, and that was that the parents were very angry with him because there weren't enough English teachers to start teaching South Korean children English in first grade instead of second grade. And they demanded that the South Korean president import more English teachers so their kids could get a head start on competing in the global marketplace. And he said, you know, this is what we're up against. We're already behind South Korea in many educational categories. And this is what we're up against, he said. And then I come out of that meeting with the South Korean president, and all the American media wants to ask me is, have you read Sarah Palin's book? And the president just shakes his head in disgust and says, true story, true story. Then he went on to say that he saw his job as returning a sense of seriousness to the Congress and to the American people as he tried to do in his inaugural address, you know, sober people up about these complex challenges that we face. And so I think he feels like his faith in the American people was validated by his election and that he doesn't need to talk down to them or use sound bites or catchphrases with them. And that sentiment was captured in something that he said to some aides one day when healthcare was really in trouble and he was sinking fast in the polls. And Obama, during the campaign, had kept some charms in his pocket that had been given to him, lucky charms, on the campaign trail. And Rahm Emanuel asked him, are you still feeling lucky? And Obama replied, my name is Barack Hussein Obama, so hell yeah, I'm feeling lucky. And, you know, that kind of like summarizes his attitude, which is, look, the American people are smart. They can sort it out. They voted for a guy named Barack Hussein Obama to make their president, and I don't have to talk down to them. And I think over time, he's starting to learn that he still doesn't want to talk down to them, but he needs to talk to them in ways that are more memorable.
Jonathan Alter's latest book is The Promise, President Obama Year One, published by Simon & Schuster. So, Jonathan, if I can ask you about this, and I'm glad you led us into healthcare, because there are those of us who think that Roosevelt thought bigger than Obama. You've just described Obama as a pragmatist. We got Social Security, which I'm now on. Thank God. It's a wonderful program. And I'm just wondering whether or not Obama could have used his considerable leverage that he gained with all of those votes to bring us a different kind of health care program had he wanted to.
No, absolutely not. First of all, in a couple of areas, he exceeded Roosevelt. And, you know, my last book, The Defining Moment, was about Roosevelt's first 100 days. In constant dollars, even 1933 dollars, Obama's public investment far exceeded Roosevelt's in his first year. Now, Roosevelt then caught up with all sorts of other programs, and he did direct hiring through the WPA, direct government hiring. I thought that Obama made a mistake by not introducing a jobs program that at least had some direct hiring, although the 250,000 slots for AmeriCorps were precisely the same as Roosevelt's 250,000 slots for the Civilian Conservation Corps in 1933. But it's true that he could, if you look over Roosevelt's first couple terms with the New Deal, you know, he hasn't caught up to Roosevelt, but he was faster than Roosevelt on his big social program. Roosevelt waited 2 years from 1933 until 1935 before he introduced Social Security. And at the time it passed in 1935, there were a lot of liberals who did not like Social Security at all. They thought it was a horrible bill, and they weren't entirely wrong. It only insured fewer than 40% of senior citizens. It was a thoroughly racist bill. The Southern Democrats had managed to exclude all occupations that African Americans held. But Roosevelt, like Obama, knew that you have to start somewhere, and you can't make the perfect the enemy of the good, as Obama puts it. You have to take what you can get. And the idea that with no votes to spare, that he could have waved a magic wand and gotten a public option or, you know, much less a single payer plan, both of which I favor, by the way, is not in touch with the reality of Washington. The country is actually moving to the right in 2009 in ways that hampered Obama. So, for instance, he knew, as he told me, that the bank bailouts would be toxic, even though that money has been paid back. But he was really surprised that the $787 billion recovery program, which was much, much greater than anything Roosevelt did in terms of public investment, he thought that it would have some bipartisan support. There were a lot of Republican economists who knew that we had to do what we could to prevent a depression. And yet he got no Republican support on the House side and very little on the Senate side. And I think he thought that the auto bailouts would be popular with the American people, that saving those auto jobs. And again, if General Motors had liquidated, we would have had a depression. You have to remember that at the time Obama took office, we were losing 740,000 jobs a month. And if we had stayed on that path, we would have been in another Great Depression, no exaggeration, by the end of 2009. The problem for him politically, as he knows, is that that's what he calls a counterfactual. That unemployment didn't go to 20% is an abstraction for people. So it was easier for Roosevelt in that he didn't have to deal with war in 1933. It wasn't until the late 1930s, 7-8 years later, that he had to deal with foreign policy in any significant way. And also, Roosevelt got more credit for beginning to pull us out of a depression than Obama could get for the abstraction of preventing a depression. And on health care, Obama's decision to move forward with his major legislation faster than Roosevelt did was done over the objections of everybody around him. Joe Biden said, don't do this now. The American people will give you a pass. They want you to work on the economy first. Rahm Emanuel told me, quote, I begged the president not to do this. David Axelrod felt the same way. The economic advisors felt the same way, that it was just too heavy a lift in his first year. But when I asked him, so why'd you do it? He said, well, if we didn't do it at the beginning, it wouldn't get done. And you have to realize that the public option, which, as I said, I was very, very much in favor of, the word public option, the expression, was not mentioned a single time by a single candidate for president in a single speech, debate, or piece of literature for all of 2008. This was something that the left in the United States became rather obsessed about in 2009. It was an important part, but only one part, of the largest piece of social legislation since Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. This bill has so much in it. The Republicans made fun of it for being so long. It has so much in it that transforms our health care system, even though it doesn't turn it into, you know, Medicare for all, which is what I would have favored. But it has so many other things in it, and we could spend hours discussing some of those things, almost none of which got through. And that goes back to Obama's problem framing a message. Again, the issue of your broadcast, words. He did not, as Valerie Jarrett put it, ever find the right vocabulary to sell health care. Now, it was a hard sell no matter what, because 95% of people who vote have health insurance already, and they don't really care very much about people who don't. So the politics of health care reform were always going to be brutal, because the uninsured don't vote, and the compassion level of those who do is limited. But having said that, you have to blame Obama for not finding the right words to fully connect with the American people, or even to tell liberals and seniors what was in the bill for them. And there was quite a bit. He tried to do it, but his allergy to catchphrases and metaphors and human ways of connecting with people with language, his failure to frame the issue properly, hampered him all through 2009. On the other hand, he won ugly, but he did win.
Let me ask you about this. Obviously, Obama comes in, George Bush has really screwed things up, and Obama's people clearly want him to convince the American people, remember what we had to work with here. Has he been successful at that?
No, and after they lost Massachusetts to the Republicans, Obama said to his team, you know, we didn't make that clear enough, and that hurt us politically. We were so busy trying to get out of the ditch that we didn't remind people how we got into the ditch in the first place. He's trying to do that in the 2010 midterms. He's out on the campaign trail using actually a pretty good soundbite where he says, you know, they drove the car into the ditch and now they want us to give them the keys back. But he didn't do that, and he didn't, for a variety of reasons, blame his predecessor enough. You know, Franklin Roosevelt spent years blaming Herbert Hoover, and Ronald Reagan spent years blaming Jimmy Carter. But I think some of their polling shows that the American people wouldn't be receptive to that right now. And so he owns a lot of these problems at this point. He felt like he had to, even before he became president, he lobbied as president-elect to get the second part of TARP through, the second $350 billion portion of TARP. This was Bush's initiative, and he knew that joining with Bush to get this done, he described it to me as toxic, politically suicidal, but he felt he had to do it in order to prevent a depression. More than 75% of it has been paid back already, which I don't think the American people understand.
We're talking to Jonathan Alter. Wonderful new book, The Promise, President Obama, Year One, Simon & Schuster. Okay, so Jonathan, I guess I got to ask you, based on what we're hearing, is he a one-term president or a two-term president?
Well, I asked the president that question, and he gave what I think was the right answer, which was it's too soon to tell. And I'm less interested in predictions about the future, which probably won't be accurate, than I am in trying to tell people a lot of things that they don't know about the recent past. Because we think by reading the newspapers that we're kind of up on everything, and there's always a backstory. You know, in the case of the promise, candidate Obama breaking up a near fist fight in the White House between Barney Frank and Hank Paulson. You've got what happened behind closed doors at the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference, which Obama crashed the meeting with the leaders of the developing countries that he wasn't invited to. You have really dramatic things in the healthcare story and the president dressing down the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and General McChrystal in 2009. So the reason that McChrystal was fired in 2010 was that there was history with Obama. He had already been to the woodshed once. And so for people to understand what's going on now or what might happen in the future, they have to, I think, understand what happened behind closed doors to date. And so that's what I try to do in The Promise.
So if you listen to the inaugural, which we have all done together, Jonathan Alter, is what was in the inaugural coming to pass in terms of what you would expect in terms of development of policy?
Yes. I think in the policy parts of the inaugural, and inaugurals don't have much policy, but when it came to the parts where he talked about, you know, extending a hand to the rest of the world, I think he said, we'll extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist. And he's made good on that. In some cases, you know, rogue states have unclenched their fists a bit and there's been more contact. And in other cases, they haven't, and there hasn't been as much contact as they had hoped. So it's a mixed record on that. But I think his stern warning on terrorism is something that he's made good on. He's actually used Predator drones to kill more high-value al-Qaeda targets than George W. Bush did in 8 years. And so there was that hard-nosed part of the speech that he's made good on. I think where he has failed is in moving toward a more post-partisan era, which was a very big theme that he was proclaiming an end to petty grievances. Now, that just hasn't happened at all. So in that sense, he was too optimistic in his inaugural about where the country could go. But I think he has been remarkably successful in keeping the bulk of his campaign promises. And I took note of a nonpartisan independent outfit called PolitiFact that added up all of his promises from the campaign. There were about 500 of them, and he's either kept or made significant progress in keeping close to 400. So to the extent that the inaugural address offered a new direction for the country, he's at least begun to make good on that, but has not succeeded in lessening the rancor of American politics.
Now, how do we know, Jonathan Alter, that when he said that in the address, after all, he's a brilliant man, he wasn't perfectly aware of, you know, the fact that they were going to give him as hard a time as they possibly could, and that he wanted it on the record that he had asked for it, a sort of a preemptive device.
I think that's a great point. You know, he was, even by that time, by January 20th, the Republicans were already signaling that they weren't going to be cooperating. So I think he wanted credit for trying and credit for extending his hand to them. And that's why, to the frustration of many liberals, you know, he continues to do so, because he does want to strike that Abraham Lincoln-style approach where, you know, even after the Civil War, he says in his second inaugural, "With malice toward none, with charity for all," to be a bigger man. And as Woodrow Wilson said, the president can be as big a man as he can be. And I think Obama is conscious of standing apart and above the fray to the extent that he can. The problem is to calibrate the detachment in such a way that he stands apart from the fray, but not aloof from it. And I think he's had some difficulty in finding that right tone in which to connect with the American people. You know, when Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945 and his funeral procession was making its way up Constitution Avenue, a grieving man fell to his knees and another man next to him helped him to his feet and asked, "Did you know the president?" And the first man said of Roosevelt, the grieving man, "No, but he knew me." And somehow Franklin Roosevelt, this aristocrat, this patrician who didn't grow up with ordinary people, a combination of his first-class temperament, as it was described, and his ability to use language to connect allowed him to give millions of Americans a sense that he really knew them. It was partly the programs, but partly the way he presented himself. And Barack Obama is gifted. It would be a terrible mistake to underestimate this man. But he hasn't yet found the right key in which to connect with the American middle class and give them that sense that he really, truly knows them and their struggles. But he has some time, and he has a tremendous amount of self-awareness and a capacity for renewal. So the story continues.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank our expert today, Jonathan Alter, senior editor at Newsweek, columnist, TV commentator, acclaimed author. His latest book is The Promise, President Obama Year One, published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks also to our producer, David Gustina, the National Archives and Records Administration for providing the speech, and a special thanks to Bob Bullock from the Archives Partnership Trust. Be sure to join us next time for another discussion about a great political speech on the power of words.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.